Level 1 trauma centers are the best at handling medical emergencies. Now that Chicago has just opened its latest Level 1 center on the city's south side, today we check in on how many other similar trauma centers exist for the rest of Illinois. Also, state Republicans and Democrats are arguing over whether or not to change our flat income tax system, even though it will take a change from our Constitution. House Democrats even recently released a video with a rare appearance from House Speaker Michael Madigan.
House Democrats are fighting to have a fair tax for Illinoisans, not a tax that helps the billionaires and the millionaires like Bruce Rauner.
We'll talk about that and the latest in state politics with Brian Mackey and Mark Maxwell. And warm weather's finally here, but so is the rain, and too much of it, and it turns into stormwater pollution. U of I students just won a national competition to design a possible solution on their campus. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Level 1 trauma centers are places that are capable of handling any type of medical emergency. But depending on where you live in Illinois, it's not unusual to travel an hour or two to get critical care you might need. We're going to be talking about trauma care throughout Illinois in a minute, but first, for nearly 30 years, the south side of Chicago didn't have an adult Level 1 trauma center. But last week, University of Chicago Medicine opened its new Level 1 trauma program, meaning that patients in the area no longer have to travel for miles in order to get that specialized medical attention. Lisa Schenker has been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Lisa, in a recent article, you wrote about the story of Candace Denard and her brother Damien, which I think is a story that illustrates why so many community and public health activists have been advocating for the center in Hyde Park for years. Can you tell us their story?
Sure. Damien Turner was an 18-year-old activist, and in 2010, he was shot in the Woodlawn neighborhood. He wasn't the intended victim, but he was shot. He was only about four blocks from the University of Chicago Medical Center at the time, but because it didn't have an adult level one trauma center, he was taken by ambulance to Northwestern, which was nearly 10 miles away, and he ended up dying at Northwestern. But that event represented kind of a turning point when it came to activists' efforts to try to get a level one adult trauma center at the University of Chicago on the south side.
And how did community activists, what have they been doing for the past couple of years to try to advocate for this?
Sure, their efforts, they've just been trying to be very visual. They had protests, they had sit-ins, they have held vigils. Some of them were even arrested in 2013 when they wouldn't leave a protest. They've been trying to make themselves an issue that the University of Chicago had to confront.
And University of Chicago Medicine is obviously a renowned medical school. It's a major hospital. It's well known throughout not just Chicago and Illinois, but the country. Why was it so difficult to have a level one trauma care center established at that hospital?
Well, they actually had a level one adult trauma center there in the 80s, but only for about 2 years, and then they shut it down in 1988. At the time and historically, level one adult trauma centers have been big money losers, especially when you are in an area like the south side of Chicago. A lot of the patients are on Medicaid, which is federal and state health insurance program for low-income people, and Medicaid doesn't pay hospitals. It doesn't cover the full cost of caring for patients, so hospitals end up eating the cost. So I think that was one concern on the University of Chicago's part. They were worried that the cost of it would take away from other programs that they offered. And I think they also felt for a time like they wanted to see a regional effort. They didn't want to be solely responsible for a trauma center on the south side. They wanted a partnership, and they did have a partnership planned at one point with one of the other hospitals, but they ended up backing out of that one with Sinai Health System and decided to start their own.
And community activists really renewed their efforts when President Obama announced that he was going to be building his library on the South Side. Do you think that's the public pressure that activists placed in the neighborhood then was finally what led to this announcement of the trauma center?
You know, it really depends on who you ask. I mean, they certainly, when that library came into the picture, they certainly made that an issue. They said essentially they didn't think that, the activists said they didn't think it was in the spirit of these efforts to attract the library to the South Side to also not have an adult level one trauma center on the South Side. You know, you talk to some people and they say, some activists will say, yes, they absolutely think that that was the reason why the University of Chicago ultimately changed its mind. But then I asked the University of Chicago about it and they said, no, that was not the reason that they decided to go ahead with it.
Either way, there is now this level one trauma program at University of Chicago Medicine, opened as of last week. But in your reporting, Lisa, you've shown that some members of the community still have concerns about health needs being met. What are those concerns?
Well, I think that they want to make sure that the, number one, that the trauma center is going to be here to stay, just given the history of trauma centers closing across the city, including at the University of Chicago in the 80s. I think they're also working with the University of Chicago to try to make sure that there are more services for people, especially victims of violence after they leave the hospital, that there's a violence recovery program, behavioral health and social services, violence prevention programs.
Lots of, it sounds like lots of course, other issues that all relate to public health that are important for the South Side of Chicago and for the city. Lisa Schenker has been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. Lisa, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That inspired us to wonder what level one trauma centers look like outside of Chicago. And joining me now to discuss this from Springfield is Dr. John Setyuk. He's director of the Southern Illinois Trauma Center at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Also on the line from Chicago is Dr. Richard Fantas. He's the director of the Illinois Trauma Advisory Council and is also a trauma surgeon at Advocate Illinois Masonic. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Fantas, let's start with you. I wonder if you can just help us parse the distinctions between trauma levels and if you can, we've been talking about level one. People hear these terms sort of thrown around like a level one, level two, level three. What does it mean when we say that?
Well, nationally, the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma publishes a guideline for optimal resources of the injured patient and outlines the various requirements necessary for the different levels of trauma centers. Level one trauma center obviously is the one with the most capabilities, requires in-house capability 24 hours a day, a surgeon, in-house anesthesiologist, operating room, and the rapid availability of medical and surgical specialists within a given time frame. Level two has similar capabilities, but most of those are not in the hospital immediately available, but need to respond within 30 minutes or 60 minutes. So they're able to ramp up to meet the need once a patient arrives or once they get notification of a patient arrival. In Illinois, those are the only two levels we have. We don't have level threes or fours. We've actually been trying to get a piece of legislation introduced to expand the trauma system in Illinois to recognize three levels of trauma centers and a fourth level, which would be an acute injury stabilization center.
Dr. Setyuk, you have a trauma center you direct in Southern Illinois. How far are patients traveling to come to you all to get treatment?
Yeah, when I heard 10 miles, that's short for us. We have about a third of our patients are transfers, which means they are seen at another critical access hospital before they come to us. And so those patients can range anywhere from 30, 40 miles up to over 100 miles away that are transferred in. Those patients have a significant longer time from injury till they arrive at our center. our local patients, and you're giving consideration for time of entry and whether people call for help or et cetera, are definitely under an hour before we see them from time of injury. But our transfer patients, they can go from 3 to 5 hours or longer from time of injury till they finally get to our institution.
And does that time make a difference in care or an outcome?
That time definitely makes a difference. If you look at nationally some data, about half of all the people that die in traffic injuries die on rural roads, and yet only about 20% of the population lives in a rural area. So there's a much higher fatality rate, and that's not due just because of the hospitals per se, but you know that's the roads, the quality of the roads, the access to care, the ability for people to find the victims. But definitely the fatality rate is greater the further you get and the further you get away from a trauma center.
And Dr. Sogyak, I wonder if you can just give us a sense. Is it mostly, what kind of injuries are you dealing with? Is it, I mean, we hear a lot about gunshot wounds, gunshot victims. That's something that people hear about a lot, I think, in the media. But are you mostly dealing with accidents? Is it traffic accidents?
So an interesting thing, again, nationally, is we're doing a lot of people that fall. We see a fair amount of older trauma patients, people in their 80s and 90s that have a simple fall, and they're on medications. And, you know, again, they suffer what might seem to be mild injury, but they become critically ill. Then we have motor vehicle crashes. We have ATV, motorcycle crashes, off-road accidents, farming accidents, either with animals or equipment. Our shootings, our violence, I'll just go to the gunshots. We looked at our numbers, and about half of our gunshots were either accidental or were suicides. So, you know, we see more on that range of the accidents and suicide, I think, than you see in some of the urban areas.
And what is, I know we're here, our station here in Urbana is pretty close to Carl, so we hear the helicopter every now and then. Is that, how are people getting to your facility from other parts of the state? Is it a helicopter? Is it an ambulance? How does that work?
The vast majority come by ground ambulance. You know, the helicopters are great when the weather is perfect. But around, as you know, in southern Illinois, the weather isn't always perfect. It's anything from high winds to cold, to precipitation, tornado warnings. So most of our patients are coming by ground ambulance, and we have a ground ICU care ambulances, so they can provide almost mobile ICU level care.
And Dr. Fantas, when we think about the landscape of trauma centers across Illinois, we've been talking about this one level one center in southern Illinois, and then Bloomington Normal does not have a level one trauma center. Rockford has two. Do you feel like that when we look across Illinois, there are enough trauma centers?
Well, I think if you look at the total numbers, I think there are enough trauma centers to handle the population of Illinois. Unfortunately, there's a geographic disparity, and unlike Starbucks, where they can put a enterprise on a corner that would be ideal for the population and the volume, trauma centers have been in hospitals that have been in places that have existed before the trauma system. So I think we see, as Dr. Sutyak pointed out, below I-72, there are no in-state trauma centers, and that's a significant portion of the state. There are, however, some Illinois trauma centers that have been designated in Indiana and in Missouri that serve some of those regions. But I think there is a significant area that would benefit either by a level three or possibly a level two trauma center. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't really have level threes, so that would be another reason to look at this legislation, and it would open up some of the hospitals that are populated down in the southern portions of the state give them the capacity to meet those criteria, which are less stringent than a level one or a level two.
And Dr. Fantas, how much of this is the cost of it? As we heard Lisa Schenker talking about University of Chicago and how expensive it is, this level of care to provide, especially when hospitals think about how much they're getting back from the patient base. Is that the main prohibition to other hospitals having this?
Well, I've been in this for over 30 years, and things have changed dramatically over the landscape of healthcare economics. And I don't think anybody goes into trauma care to make money. It's part of the mission and values of the institutions that they belong to or belong with. And I think you need to have a certain amount of resources available or able to scale up to those. And when you're looking at some of the hospitals in the southern part of the state, they're not large hospitals to start with. So it'd be extremely difficult for them to enter the trauma system as a level two, which requires the 30-minute response times that I mentioned earlier. But if there was a level three, they could at least be part of the system, stabilize the patients to their ability. If the patient had a ruptured spleen, treat that and then move them to the next level of care. So I think it would at least stabilize some of the patients that would not do well if they had to travel or take 3 to 4 hours to get to definitive trauma care.
We have to take a break. I'm hoping both of you can stick around for just one more question after this, just to wrap up this conversation about trauma centers, level one care facilities throughout Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about level one trauma care across Illinois. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Dr. John Sutyuk. He's director of the Southern Illinois Trauma Center, which is based at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. On the line from Chicago, Dr. Richard Fantas is a trauma surgeon at Advocate Illinois Masonic, and he's also director of the Illinois Trauma Advisory Council. Dr. Sutyuk, I wonder, as we're thinking about these times, and I'm just thinking about the beginning of this conversation and how a difference of 10 miles made a difference in this one person's life, perhaps, are you worried? Is there a sense that maybe in particularly more rural parts of Illinois that there are people who are dying because they haven't been able to get to a facility in time?
I think statistically you would have to think that there are people who are dying due to bleeding. What we are trying to do to address that is we go out to these smaller critical access hospitals and meet with them. We do a rural trauma team development course. We talk about what to do in these situations, what their resources are, and what they can do to stabilize that patient as best as possible, and what they can do to facilitate the transfer of that patient. I think that is something that's helping, although I don't have data on that.
And Dr. Fantas, I wonder, in addition to that, you've mentioned this law that you all are advocating for a couple of times. What do you think needs to be done to help make this a better situation?
Well, I think we need to find a legislative sponsor that's willing to take this initiative forward. It's been on the table for 2 or 3 years. And I think given some of the inadequacies or areas that would benefit from some level of trauma care above and beyond a critical access hospital, which doesn't even may not even have a physician in-house, I think that's what we're looking for, someone to step up to the plate and assist us in sponsoring this legislation to move it forward, to make it more of an inclusive trauma system throughout the state, to have level 1, 2, 3 and this injury stabilization center.
I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us, Dr. Richard Fantas with the Illinois Trauma Advisory Council, Dr. Don Sutnick with Southern Illinois Trauma Center. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of legislation, state lawmakers have now about 3 weeks to agree on a budget for the state government. Democrats and Republicans have also been arguing over the state's flat income tax, even though a change like that wouldn't happen without a constitutional amendment. And there's a legal battle between Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Brady and Senator Sam McCann, who has just launched a third-party bid for governor. As usual, there's a lot going on in state politics. This Monday morning, we've got two Springfield political reporters to help make sense of it. On the line from Springfield, Mark Maxwell is Capital Bureau Chief at WCIA3. Mark, welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. And with us here in person at our Urbana studios is Brian Mackey, who reports on politics and government for Illinois Public Radio. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Nyla. How are you?
Brian, can we start with this question of a progressive income tax? And just to remind everybody, Illinois has a flat income tax that can only be changed through an amendment to our Constitution. Why is this something that both Democrats and Republicans are suddenly having a lot of discussion about?
Well, for one thing, J.B. Pritzker has really made it one of the centerpieces of his campaign for governor. So he says that he is going to work hard to get this on the ballot before voters in 2020 when he's governor. And he's even talked about doing things within the existing tax law to make Illinois sort of a pseudo progressive tax so that maybe you'd get more deduction opportunities at the lower income levels than you would have at the higher ones while he is trying to push that. And I think Democrats have decided, well, since our standard bearer is doing this, let's just all kind of get on board with the program. Republicans have a sort of gut resistance to any sort of change like this in the tax code. They say that the flat tax is one of the few bright spots in Illinois' appeal to businesses and outsiders, and so they're opposing it pretty strongly. I do think something to consider here, and I you never know polling changes over time, but there was a poll last year, I've talked about this before, from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute that showed that the graduated income tax is quite popular. And even among Republicans, a majority of Republicans and conservatives supported the going to a graduated income tax. So I think Democrats sense a winning political issue. But, we'll see how that shakes out as millions and millions of dollars are spent to frame it as positive on the Democratic side and negative for Republicans.
And we even had a rare appearance by House Speaker Mike Madigan in a video that House Democrats released. Let's take a listen to some of that.
When Bruce Rauner states that he's against a fair tax for Illinois, what he really means is he wants to help himself and all of his billionaire and millionaire friends.
That's a video released by House Democrats. Mark, how much of this is a political calculus of Democrats perhaps wanting to take advantage of that polling that Brian mentioned, but then also this is an issue that they think will be very popular with voters come this fall?
Well, in terms of what's happening in Springfield in the legislature this year in 2018, it's 100% purely political because this is all about positioning for the election. There is no chance of a progressive income tax passing through the state house and getting the governor's signature this year. Even if they were to pass this Massachusetts model that Senator Don Harmon has proposed, where you raise the flat tax on everyone and then give exemptions based on your income. In the meantime, Governor Rauner has already said he would strongly oppose that and veto it, and it's unlikely that would actually pass. So this is purely about positioning, especially as you can see from Speaker Madigan sort of putting his best Bernie Sanders impression to the test there, with millionaires and billionaires. But that does set up an interesting conversation because now you have to look at Governor Rauner and his challenger, J.B. Pritzker, who himself is a billionaire, who's saying with his campaign that he's willing to pay more or a higher rate. The question is, what is the middle class and how much income is that, and who will pay less? How many people will actually see a tax cut? And those details are where this will start to shake out if we can get them from the candidates.
Well, and that was the other question I was just going to ask you, Brian. The question I have is, where are the details of this? Because we've certainly heard a lot of conversation when J.B. Pritzker was running for office, and all of the candidates who are running talked about this, almost all of them. very few of them offered details. J.B. Pritzker is not an exception at this point.
Yes, Bob Diber, I think, is the only one that who actually put out rates.
Mm-hmm.
He was the Madison County School Superintendent. I think he finished in the low single digits in the polling. So
but he attached numbers.
He did attach numbers and rates so people could actually decide whether they would see personally a tax increase or a tax cut. Charlie Wheeler, my colleague on State Week and at the University of Illinois Springfield, has done an analysis and found that, you know, based on the median income levels, you know, if Illinois were to adopt Missouri's tax structure, you would probably pay less income tax if you were at the median income in Illinois. And if we adopted one that's more like Iowa, you would probably pay more. But as Mark said, the candidates aren't, or J.B. Pritzker at this point, isn't putting out any details. And I personally am a little confounded at that, because if, you know, there are ways you can structure this tax so that the majority of Illinoisans would see a tax decrease. And, you know, by not doing that, I guess he doesn't give the Republicans ammunition to go after him. But on the other hand, it just lets Republicans say, well, we know Democrats will raise taxes, even if they're not saying what the numbers are. They just can't help themselves. So they're able to fill in the blanks for J.B. Pritzker. Who knows? There's a long time between now and November. He may come out with a more specific plan.
We're talking state politics with Brian Mackey from Illinois Public Radio and WCIA3's Capital Bureau Chief Mark Maxwell on the line from Springfield. Mark, let's move to the Republican side of the governor's race. And I wanted to ask you specifically about State Senator Sam McCann, who announced a run for governor a few weeks ago under the banner of the Conservative Party. Governor Rauner's campaign slammed him pretty much right out of the gate. But I wanted to ask you, over the past week, Senator McCann's been in a dispute with Senate Democrats, particularly Bill Brady. And he even filed a lawsuit saying that he was kicked out. I'm sorry, Senate Republicans. He even filed a lawsuit saying he was inappropriately kicked out of the caucus. What is that about?
Well, the Senator Bill Brady, the minority leader, is loyal to Bruce Rauner and that wing of the party. Even though he's had his own policy differences with the governor, he's, for all intents and purposes, a Rauner loyalist. But Senator Sam McCann is anything but, and he's cast several votes supporting unions in the past that really irritated Governor Rauner, to the point where Governor Rauner tried to oust McCann through the primary process by running opponents against him twice, and twice failed. And now Senator McCann is seeking to launch his third party bid as a conservative candidate. When he did that, Senate Republicans said that he effectively vacated his position as a Senate Republican. McCann disagrees. He says he's still a duly elected senator of the 50th District, and he intends to stay a Senate Republican until January of 2019. The problem is that when he walked away, now they're saying he's been cut off. He's filed this federal lawsuit saying he doesn't have access to special bill analysis when all this flurry of bills will come across his desk when he's expected to cast informed votes on them. He won't have all the background beyond just the language of the bill itself, and he says that's helpful. Also, access to a staff photographer or a communications person who can help to craft press releases and keep him in touch with voters in his district. He says this hobbles his ability to be an effective lawmaker. In fact, spelled out in his lawsuit that he doesn't feel he can effectively do his job to the same degree as all the other lawmakers if he's sort of being shunned like this. But that's Senate Republicans say, hey, you chose your bed, now you have to sleep in it. You've isolated yourself. And so whether or not a judge agrees with Senator McCann remains to be seen. If a judge does not give him that restraining order granted, where he would have to be allowed access to that staff again, well, then the senator would be in quite a pickle, because he's already admitted that without those resources, he doesn't feel he could do his job, and Senate Republicans would likely ask for him to step down.
I think there's a really interesting glimpse into how Springfield works that we can learn from this process. Everybody talks about, oh, the leaders are so powerful, Speaker Madigan so powerful, President Cullerton so powerful. And this is one way in that you see that they are, because unlike in Washington, where individual legislators hire their own staffs and they'll have their own communications person that they hire, most of the staff in Springfield is centralized in the leadership offices. And so if you are not on board with the leader, then you are not going to get not only good committee assignments, but as we're seeing here,
and
with
access
Senator
to the
McCain,
press. And I think we know this as journalists, that we know there's a couple folks that you call. Not every state senator or representative has an individual press contact or necessarily a staff person. But that's how oftentimes what we do when we're trying to get a hold of people. That's what we're talking about here, too.
And Senator McCain is pretty most reporters who cover him regularly have his cell phone. He's fairly responsive. Mm-hmm. However, this thing of the bill analyses, I know we all would like to think that legislators read every page of every bill that they vote on, but they are voting on hundreds of bills. Sometimes you could vote on a bill every few minutes. Each one is tens, if not hundreds of pages. These analyses are pretty crucial for understanding what you're voting on. And so if you don't have access to that, I think that can make it hard to do one's job. Now, as you know, whether that's means that McCain should, as Mark said, did he make his bed? Should he have to lie in it? That's a question for apparently now the courts to decide. It is something that could really affect his ability to understand what he's voting on.
Mark,
this isn't only a Washington thing. Just other states also have nonpartisan staff as well. Illinois, I don't know the breakdown of all 50 states, but Washington isn't the only place where you can get staffers and communications right from your office that are nonpartisan. Illinois is at least somewhat unique in that regard.
And Mark, can I ask also just about how this is also spilling over into votes for party leadership? I saw some news this morning about Jeannie Ives and who she's supporting in terms of leadership within the party. Do you think that Sam McCain and Jeannie Ives, who, of course, just a reminder to everybody, mounted a very close campaign against Governor Rauner in the primary, represent a very different part of the Republican Party right now?
Well, Sam McCain is most certainly going after Jeannie Ives' primary base. But they do represent two very different parts of the party. Jeannie Ives would not take very many of the pro-union positions that Sam McCain does. She's a suburban Republican. He's a downstate Republican. They share some of the same issues. But to your point, a rather bizarre occurrence over the weekend where Jeannie Ives is using her campaign email, the one from her primary that she lost nearly 2 months ago, it's still active, and she's using this base of voters and all the people she's contacted to try to oust the Rauner-appointed or the Rauner pick for state party chairman. And that's coming up in a week or two now where this vote will be cast. And they think it's all coming down to one precinct, the 15th precinct in the Champaign area in central Illinois, where Senator Chapin Rose ousted another guy named that has been there for a while. And they think that one deciding vote may flip the state party from Tim Schneider to another guy named Shaw.
And to be clear, Mark, this is a vote that happens among elected officials. It's not a vote that happens within just sort of like a anyone can vote kind of thing.
Right. At the primary, everybody comes out and they vote for their precinct committeeman and the people in the area that will take this vote. So then they go off to a private room and the elected officials then cast their vote to pick the leader of the party. And really, it's very much a fight between the Rauner vision of the Republican Party in Illinois, the sort of pseudo-libertarian slash corporate, I'll call it the Mitt Romney slash Scott Walker wing of the Republican Party, in the national optics, and the Jeannie Ives, Donald Trump sort of populist cut our taxes wing. And it's really an interesting split that is very active. And the Democratic Governors Association, the DGA, has been reminding and hounding even reporters that this lingering tension exists in the Republicans in Illinois, and it's really picking up steam. It's not going away.
We just have about a minute left, Brian. Just want to ask you about budget negotiations. Governor Rauner said this morning that budget talks have been frustratingly slow. Just with a minute left, if you can just kind of fill us in on what we've got ahead this week.
Yeah, I mean, we still have a month left in Springfield time. That's like
four years, 10 years,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So there's a long time to go. I think, the Republicans have been pressuring the Democrats to come out with this, agree on how much money. But, we're hearing that behind closed doors, the Rauner administration would really rather talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars that he needs to pay off bills that were incurred years ago during the impasse. So it's way too early to say whether we're going to have another impasse. the betting seems to still be no. But, you know, I'm sure that people will continue trying to make political hay out of this because that's what politicians do.
Well, the negotiations will continue, which is a better place than we were last year anyway, I will point out. I want to thank Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter, Mark Maxwell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA3, for giving us a little bit of analysis of what's been going on. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Nala.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Heavy rain and thunderstorms this past week brought down lots of water. Thankfully, not enough to cause flooding, although we know Illinois had our share of floods over the past few years. The problem in many cases is too much cement. But a team of students at the U of I has taken on this challenge and come up with a design to help prevent stormwater pollution. And that design just won first place at a national EPA Campus Rainwater Challenge. Joining me in studio in Champaign-Urbana is Jessica Wiegand, one of the students on the team. She's a senior in the College of Engineering. Professor Arthur Schmidt from the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department is one of the advisors for the team, is also here in studio. Jessica, Art, congratulations and welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica, can I start by just asking you how you or why you got interested in this issue of stormwater pollution?
Yeah, so I took a class last year and it was just like a 300 level class and it seemed interesting, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do for a job. So I saw this project and I wanted to see if it was something interesting, and I found it pretty interesting. It's something I want to do.
Art, you can't give us a 300-level class right now, but can you tell us a little bit about the problem of stormwater and why this is stormwater pollution, even what that term means?
Absolutely. So the problem comes from we've taken all the natural pervious area where water can soak in, and we put our buildings and roofs and parking lots and streets, and instead of letting the water soak in, we run it through channels and pipes to streams much faster. At the same time, all the pollution, the oil and grease and metals and things, especially from vehicles and particulates that settle, get washed off with that water. And so where there in the past there would have been more natural filtering as water soaked into the soil, now again it gets transported to the waterways very quickly.
And Jessica, how did you hear about this campus rainwater challenge?
So the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering has a blog page, and they posted on there looking for different teams to form. So went off there and decided to find a team.
And you put together a team, Jessica. You're one of the 13 people, if I'm correct, that were on the team.
Yes.
Not all engineering students?
Yes. We had a lot of different majors. We had English majors, anthropology, landscape architecture, engineering.
And why do you think that made a difference in the design that the students came up with?
I think it made a tremendous difference in the design. That early on we talked and everything was focused on the functionality and how do we deal with the water and how much water and how large. But the other students and advisors from other departments brought in a lot of other aspects. So they were considering the aesthetics, how well it fits into the campus, how it can be used as educational material, even just how different social groups may respond to things and how can we make this a more inclusive project.
And Jessica, how did you come up with the design? Can you tell us, first of all, this was a design for an existing parking lot that exists on the U of I campus right now?
Yes. So a lot of what we did, we took what was there, and then we talked to facilities and services to find out how they're wanting to change the parking lot in the future and worked off of that. So I would say it was a lot of trial and error. It was talking back and forth to facilities and services and deciding what would best fit that part and also make it more sustainable.
And what does it look like?
Well, it's pretty. I can tell you that. We have a lot of plants around the parking lot, and there's like a small pond that will form during rain events, and it will hold the storm water there. And that area has a lot of different flowers, and then that'll also attract different insects.
And is that, Art, is there, when we're thinking about that design that Jessica just talked about, with the idea of having a small pond that maybe would fill for stormwater, is that a common design solution that we see for stormwater pollution?
It's yes and no. In the old days, we just wanted to get rid of the water. Then back maybe 20 years ago, we took this concept of detention and we'll build these big ponds. You see them in subdivisions and shopping areas. And we'll collect all the water and we'll hold it and release it slowly. But often we don't get many water quality benefits. So what's new and unique about this is we're moving it back to the micro scale. And instead of one large pond for a large area, we're trying to have these little ponds where we're controlling what happens, but allowing water to infiltrate and filter near where the rain first hit the ground.
So, Jessica, is the idea that this water then can be used for other purposes, it sounds like. So not only is there, it's kind of playing a dual purpose, the design that you all created, not just collecting and preventing flooding, but also maybe is it helping also irrigate a little bit or provide water for other things?
That's something we would, it would be a good idea, but we actually did not implement that in the design. In the future, that would be something like awesome to have on campus, but we don't really do it in Illinois right now.
And where did you get your inspiration from for what you all came up with?
We had inspiration from a lot of different places. We look at Pinterest, we asked people, and then we argued about it and ended up coming up with something in the end.
And then this, did you actually submit a design to the EPA, like blueprints?
Yeah, it was a full design. We did hydraulic modeling on it and then looked at the hydraulics of the hydrology too, and then had a parking lot plan, everything planned from like where every parking spot was.
Right. And so now that you all have proposed this design, Art, is the hope that this could actually be implemented on campus?
The hope is that it would. We do run into campus politics and budget issues that we've got this design, but it's cheaper just to do things the way they are. And so to put in the landscaping, the grounds, doing what it takes to implement this costs more money. And so there is the hurdle of trying to get the higher level campus administration, particularly it's a coupling of the parking department and the facilities and services department, would have to agree and come up with a budget to do this.
And because there isn't necessarily, or at least to my knowledge, there isn't necessarily problems with flooding on campus right now, although there certainly is a lot of concrete, is that, I wonder what other benefits you can point to for having a system like this that maybe are, Jessica, do you want to, I wonder if you can let us know, like, just the fact that there's more greenery, what kind of environmental benefits there are just to having this kind of design versus maybe a more typical or older concrete structure?
So right now with the storm water, it runs off the parking lots and into the storm sewers. Then we discharge that into Boneyard Creek or the local waterways. So that's not being treated at all, that storm water. So it's helping pollute the waterways. If we add green infrastructure, then that'll help infiltrate it and then give some pollutant control before it goes into the Boneyard Creek.
And Art, go ahead.
I was going to say there's a lot of other, sometimes they're called co-benefits. So the green space doesn't absorb heat as much as the paved parking lots, so it reduces some of the urban heat island effect, and there can be health benefits of that. Also, the vegetation greenery tends to absorb some of the airborne pollutants and also reduce noise. There's shading benefits, so if you have more tree canopy, there's benefits, again, heat-wise and health-wise. So a lot of benefits in addition to just the water and water quality benefits.
And as we have folks listening throughout the state who might be listening to this particular design and thinking about the design of their house, Art, when people are thinking about designing homes or offices or businesses, if they are, I don't know if they're, if it's, it must be harder to take an existing facility and make it green than to build a new one green, right?
In general, it is, although there's a lot of good to taking an existing facility. When we take a new one, we're generally taking a natural area and urbanizing it and adding to the problems. Whereas if we take an existing one, we may have to remove something and work the site some, but we're improving something that's already detrimental. So in many ways, it's better to try to take infill as opposed to expansion.
And so for people who are listening and thinking, what can I do in my home to help prevent stormwater pollution in my neighborhood, what kind of suggestions would you make to them?
My number one suggestion is take your gutter downspouts, and instead of routing them to the driveway where it's carried on a concrete surface out to the street and to the pipes, if you can route that over the lawn, we've done studies that show that's one of the most beneficial grain practices that can be done, and yet it's very inexpensive to do.
And Jessica, it also sounds like if we're routing things correctly, we're also not polluting our natural waterways, which is something you just pointed out.
We're definitely helping. I mean, we're still going to pollute them somewhat. The water's not clean. We have oil from the parking lots and different things, but whatever we can do to help.
And Art, in the time that you've been studying this issue, do you think we've gotten better at dealing with stormwater, or is this something that's more difficult because of the construction that continues and the amount of concrete and cement services that we have?
No, we've gotten much better. Many corporations now are actively trying to incorporate these practices and what they do just because the public has recognized. And so even though it costs a little bit more money, we're recognizing there's also downstream costs and benefits that make it worth doing this. So there's much more emphasis on this around the country.
And what about here on the U of I campus? Do you think there's too much concrete?
Yes.
That's your short answer.
Yeah, there is a lot, but there's a lot being done. Campus has their Illinois Climate Action Plan that has been revised and reapproved about 2 years ago. And then they have a Sustainability Council that's chaired by the Chancellor and the Provost is a part of. And then a ICAP Climate Action Plan Working Group that advises the Sustainability Council. And then I'm part of they have Sustainability Working Advisory Teams or SWAT teams. I'm chair of the one for water sustainability. And so we make recommendations to the working group who passes it on to the provost level that the campus is very actively trying to become much more sustainable, both with water and stormwater, but other issues, waste management, energy consumption, vehicle use, many things.
Jessica, what did this design in this competition teach you about a stormwater pollution? Is there anything in particular that you feel like you learned from it that you want to share with folks?
I think I more understood the complexity of the issue. Like in a class, sometimes it'll seem really straightforward, but then when you actually go into designing something, you realize there's a lot of different complexities to it. And then realizing that to make a nice design, you really have to get the people from other majors, not just engineering, to help out.
And do you think this is a design that you would like to see elsewhere, not just on the U of I campus, but can be used in other places too?
Yeah, that would be awesome. Even other parking lots on campus, just doing one, it'll help, but it's not really going to have much of an impact. But if you would do all of them, then could do a lot more.
And what are your plans after you're a senior, I mentioned? Are you going to continue to study civil engineering?
I'm hoping to get a job, but yeah, I'd like it somewhere in the drainage and type things like that.
Okay. That's great. Art, just one last question for you, just in terms of as we're thinking about stormwater pollution, especially this time of year. You mentioned the drains. Is there anything else people should be thinking about, especially as we've seen so much rain in the past couple of weeks? We had a really dry April, but maybe we'll see some different things in May.
I think always just thinking, do I need as much of this concrete or asphalt surface? Are there ways that I can route this so instead of just going straight to the sewers, that somehow it goes across the surface where it can soak in and we get some of the natural processes happening?
That's Art Schmidt. He's a research assistant professor. He teaches in civil and environmental engineering at the U of I. I want to thank Jessica Wiegand for being with us as well. She's a senior in engineering at the University of Illinois and part of the team that won a national competition put on by the EPA, the Campus Rainwater Challenge. Both of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, warm weather's finally upon us. Maybe you're hoping to get outside. And if the first place that comes to mind is Starved Rock State Park, you're not alone. It turns out that 10.4 million people have visited Starved Rock since 2014. And park officials are having a hard time maintaining the park because of all that traffic. We're also going to be hearing about our neighbors to the west. Iowa has passed the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation. We're going to talk about what that means for people here in both Iowa and Illinois. That does it for us today. As I said, you can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. Just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. Directions for how to do that. If you want to follow us on social media, you just have to remember our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, you can search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background. You can also search for us on Facebook. Look for The 21st and like us, and you can comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you'd want us to ask on air. I said all those links, as I said, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just remember our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.